You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert Kent, the editor in chief, and I'm here with
Susie Evans, a senior editor,
a Deep Tran associate editor.
It's a very eventful week, busy, exciting. The October issue just came into our office, the print edition, probably into your mailbox or your local newsstand, if any such things still exist. And also, we've been putting the stories online, our season preview, looking forward to the 2015-16 season. It's an annual special issue. And as often noted, we often look at the top 10 plays that will be produced. This year's most produced play will be
Disgrace by Ayad Akhtar.
Yes.
And he's also the top of our top 20 most produced playwrights list for this upcoming season. So it's only the third time a playwright of color has been on the top 10 list. And we started counting the top 20 list, what, 3 years
been
ago?
Been on the top of the top 10 list. Not
yeah,
on top, the top.
Yeah, yeah, like number one spot.
Number one spot. They've been on the list
I
before.
Think we've officially done the top 20 playwrights for about 3 years. But I think we've, if you look back, there's other, it's TZ Circle has it a few times. Anyway, the top 20 playwrights is a list we decided to do some years ago, just right, for the heck of it. And then we decided this year, because there have been a lot of stories, we've done a lot of reporting about the gender disparity, the disparity between female playwrights and male playwrights programmed in seasons, not just classic revivals, but new plays. We have a sense of what the numbers are. We've crunched some numbers in the past. We decided this issue we're going to do a count of how many plays by men, how many plays by women, and also then break out new plays versus classic plays, because that seems like a meaningful metric. If you just look at history of institutional sexism, you know, you're just going to probably be more likely to find more plays by women, especially since there's more consciousness of this. And we do find the numbers, you have them at the top of your head, Susie.
I know that 22% of plays produced on stages are written by women.
It's 21, actually.
21.
But that was a late number.
Really? Well, is the count 22%?
The count was 22.
Okay, so we're 21. Basically,
the count was the Lilies.
The count is the Lilies and the Dramatists Guild, and they looked at three seasons, not the 2015-16 season. So we got 21.
Yeah,
and it was 69?
67 male. I've had to fill us out a bunch
of
times.
You got it better than I do.
And then 12 co-written. And then Deep, what's the number for new plays? Do you know off the top of your head?
If I knew, my head would be bigger.
It's around 30, I think.
29. 29. I had to write all this down and I've been arguing with offline with people about it. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Why have you been arguing with people about it?
Just this issue among many other things has raised a lot of, you know, old debates and controversies. Let's just say that.
Who is against producing female playwrights?
Nobody's against it. It's just a matter of like, this is another metric we could have used. We looked at the age of the play. We could have looked at the age of the playwright. And, you know, anecdotally, if you just look at, oh, look at all the playwrights under 50 who are produced, there might be better parity and diversity. Also, the other thing we didn't do with this issue, we didn't look at other metrics of diversity. We didn't look at directors, other theater staff. We didn't look at diversity along ethnic or racial lines.
We didn't look at representation of like actors on stage.
We did not. This is just one metric we did. And we did it because, you know, this is the list that we have every year. And we have a top 10 list, and the playwright is who we credit there, and then the top 10. So playwrights are the focus of the season
and it's also
preview.
Yeah, and it's also when theaters submit their listings to us, which is how we compile this information in the first place. They usually don't always have the directors. They will have the directors for half of their season, so it wouldn't be as representative to say
that's right.
These are the directors for this season when there will probably more directors.
The season preview is not an employment survey, right?
Right.
Other people at TCG do that, but this is the. What plays and who wrote them is the information we get and
what they wrote.
Right.
Yeah, like what kind of plays they wrote.
What kinds? What do you mean by that? You mean
new like, plays versus...
Oh, new plays versus... Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like new plays is a good metric. I mean, I get the age mm-hmm. of the playwright argument because obviously like there's some of older playwrights, there's probably more men than women just based on like the support over time of like playwrights' careers. But I feel like new plays is pretty similar to age of the playwright.
Right. It's, well, it's similar, although what's interesting is you could just at least point to a hopeful generational change that maybe in 20 years we won't be having the same conversation. It's possible.
Well, I mean, when I spoke with Lisa McNulty for my piece, the feature that's in our October issue about, you know, people that are doing gender parity well in terms of playwrights and are producing it, she said, you know, the Women's Project was founded in the late 70s and that people have been talking about it since then and it hasn't aged out in a generation.
Yeah, that's true. Well, they've been talking about a lot of things for about 50 years or more since the...
Yeah, right. I mean, it's not just a generational issue. It's a societal issue.
Right.
Though what's kind of disheartening, though I hate using that word, was just looking at the count, and they were looking at the last 3 years of productions. And then and then American Theater, we looked at this year where people were... When they were programming their season, they had Susie's article to refer to. They had a Dramatists Guild study to refer to. They had the summit to refer to. They had all these sources. And so many theaters said, we're programming the season of all women, or women is a focus this year for our season. And yet the number didn't deviate too much from previous years. So despite our better intentions, we seem to have a lot more work to do.
Yeah, when people say women are a focus for our seasons, that makes people think like they can do a one-off season of female playwrights and then go back to regular scheduled programming.
Right, and this seemed like this would, if they were doing a one-off season, this season would be the one to do it, since you have the Women's Voices Festival, you have these programming materials that Susie pointed out in her article of this is a season of women, pick the plays that you want to see.
One thing I would say is that about the last number that was quoted, 17 or 19%, the one that Marcia talked about for New York, if you look at New York in the past season, it's actually not that much better than the national. It's about 30 for new plays by women. But I would say, yes, it's dispiriting, but like that's the increase from 17 to 30. I can see why Marcia and Julia are actually pretty.
Is it 30? It's 25, I think.
I did a count on my own of new plays in New York.
Okay, so just new plays.
New plays in New York, 30%. Now that's not.
And it's the same as our count, which is 29% women.
Right.
New
so
plays.
Yeah, it's. I would just say what that says is that in New York and nationally, that's about the number. I would say that that's not great news, but it's better news. Like I would just say I'm more sanguine and hopeful that the trend line is now. The trend line is not. It's not getting better because people are getting better. It's because there's been some pressure, and I think with a lot of these things, it's like the argument with the Voting Rights Act. It's like. It's worked so well, so we don't need it anymore. No, we need to keep pressure on these things. Things have gotten better to the extent that they have because there's been pressure and talk about it and work on it. I think we can't take the pressure off is all I'm saying. But I would say it's great to acknowledge that there's been some progress, which we do. I think we do in our issue. Our issue
Susie
also
does. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, her article does. In this issue, there's deep to all the counting pieces, the gender count. And the other thing that I think is interesting, that apart from the gender part of it, a sidebar for that is looking at, in order to calculate how many women are doing new plays versus men and old plays, we had to find out how many old plays and new plays are being done. And I think this is sort of a buried, not talked about metric that's really interesting. Isaac Butler had a post about it.
Right, right. Because, and he said in the post, which I didn't even realize when we did it, was there's so much criticism about how we're only doing Shakespeare. But then when you break down the numbers, we're not doing that much Shakespeare in comparison to how much we're doing.
So what is the statistic, Rob?
The statistic is...
What are the numbers?
We decided following the rubric count. Of the count that a new play would be something that's 2005 to the present. I just in general want to get away from the idea that a new play is only a premiere. I know some people disagree with that, but I'm going to call that a new play or a contemporary play if you want to call it, but we call it a new play. Between 1964 and 1965, we called it a revival, and before that, a classic. So these were the terms we used. 64% of the coming season will be, by our definition, new plays. Plays either getting their world premiere or like probably their second or third production. Some of them, there are many, you know, multiple production if they're really popular. 18%. What's that?
Sarah Rule.
Right, Sarah Rule. 18%. Although I think she's been around for long enough that some of her are in the revival category because she's before 2005.
Like Melancholy Play, which is like a 5-year-old play. It seems to be getting revived everywhere.
Well, they made a new musical out of it.
That's true. Yeah.
So 18% of revivals and this is 13% classics. Now, of course, now you're going to get a new criticism. Like, why aren't we doing more classics? But as Isaac pointed out, 40% of those 13% classics are Shakespeare. So that's whatever it is, like 6% or less. No, that's less than that. I can't do my math. It's maybe 5% of the plays being done across the country are Shakespeare. Now, that's a disproportionate for one author. What I would love to see is more theaters that are going to do classics, do some other classics by some other people. You know, John Fletcher or, you know,
Afra Ben.
Webster. Yeah, right, Afra Ben.
Marlo. You don't have enough Marlo.
Exactly. So,
or,
in other words, support Red Bull Theater, but yes.
Or refer to Susan Jonas's article in our October issue about the other canon, which has a very handy dandy list of classic plays by women that you might not have heard of.
How do you pronounce that one? Rosvitha? Or what? How do you? Anyway.
Rosvitha?
Rosvitha.
Anyway, no, and I am not Greek. Do not ask me such things.
Well, it's not Greek. I think it's Old English or something. Yeah, so we're sort of jumping around. The other pieces we have in our gender disparity issue, in addition to Susie's great cover story and Deep's counting stories, is a piece by Joy Meads from the Center Theater Group, who, whenever you talk to her, she's one of the Kilroys, she'll talk about unconscious bias. And over the years, she's been talking about that. She mentioned that she was going to write a piece. I think she's going to write it for an internal, internal memo for CTG. And I said, why don't you write it for us? So she's got a piece about unconscious bias, which, you know, is one explanation. It may not be the silver bullet explanation, but it's one explanation for why. If you look at how many plays and how many good plays come across your desk and you work in the literary field, or you see a lot of good plays by women, and I don't know if she's done a count of how many are done, how many are submitted, how many are on her desk. But there's a lot of good plays by women, and you still look at this dispiriting number. And she chalked it up in part to unconscious bias of how we perceive what our expectations are of a female written play and versus a male play and a career of playwrights. So Teresa Eyring, our executive director, also had a piece about putting in a global perspective in the way that gender parity is a goal that is a good metric for how well a society is developing. And we could do a lot better, even though we're, you know, a developed society. Our season preview also has a list. We're about to put this up online of what people are looking forward to. We always do that every year. And this year we asked them to tell us, people in the field to tell us, what are they looking forward to that is either by women or features women prominently. So that's going up soon. So it's a very exciting issue. A lovely cover that Susie went down to D.C. to shoot. Not personally, but to supervise.
I didn't shoot it. I set it up. It's
Scott Suchman, right?
Scott Suchman shot it. It's taken at the Arena Stages Mead Center, and it's 25, I believe, playwrights from the DC Women's Voices Festival. Which is happening right now in September and October. Although I will say, talking about theaters, there's also a sidebar in the gender parity package.
Ah, yes, yes.
Theaters, they are TCG member theaters, because most of the data we have is from TCG member theaters. Yes. So, of theaters that have parity or better in their seasons. And, you know, Peter Marks made an interesting remark on Twitter that not a lot of the theaters participating in the DC Women's Voices Festival have parity. A lot of them aren't member theaters, though, so right. We didn't look at those. Right. But someone like Roundhouse has parity, but they're not a member.
Right. And a place like we've talked about before, Organ Shakes, and other places that do mostly classics or Shakespeare theater. Lincoln Center, for instance, just came out with their season. I happen to notice, and it's all men.
Yeah,
but it's four out of six women are women directors. So that's
and there's some men of color in there too.
Right. I mean, I think there are different ways to measure this, and this isn't, you know, the only way. It's also not the only way we're going to talk about it in the future. This is something we'll keep an eye on, but we're also looking at a lot of areas in the theater. So it's a moment to celebrate where we've come and how much and look for how much further we have to go.
And to celebrate us putting the five of us putting together this mammoth of an issue and still being alive afterwards.
Yes, we are still alive. And speaking of moving forward, but still a ways to go, we should touch briefly on Deep is in the midst of working on what's going to be a great piece, I know, about American musical theater's
depiction
of Asian themes and Asian American talent on stage representation. Deeply reported piece. I can't wait to read that. In the midst of this, while she's reporting on this, we had this controversy erupt, which is not exactly in the same area, but it's such the themes are similar. Do you want to take it away and tell us what happened?
Sure. I love it when discrimination just falls into my lap. But so I'm researching this piece, and then last week, the New York Gilbert and Sullivan Players released an advertisement for their production of the Mikado that was supposed to go up at New York Skirball Center at NYU in December for Christmas. And it was a predominantly white cast. From what I know now, they have only one Asian actor in their company. And so it was a white cast, and they were dressed up in Japanese kimonos and wigs, you know, chopsticks, fans, you know, the whole shebang. And of course, not surprisingly, it pissed people off because it was similar to what happened last year in Seattle with the Seattle Gilbert and Sullivan Society, where they also did a similar traditional treatment of the Mikado.
Right.
And so Leah Nanako Winkler, who is a playwright in, I think she lives either in, I think she's in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
or Queens, one of the boroughs. She wrote up a blog post, and that was an instigating event to more blog posts from Howard Sherman and Aaron Quill, as always. And then there was a big public shaming that happened on social media. and then NY Gasp, they shut down the show. And now they're going to do a reconceptual version next season. But for now, they've replaced it with Pirates of Penzance.
They just shut it down in New York, though. They're still touring that production across the country is what I heard, right?
From what I heard from Leah, she said that the buyers at those
Leah as in Salonga?
No. Not Leah Salonga. Leah Winkler, because she's been in conversation with them because she was the one who kickstarted this entire thing.
Yeah.
And she said that the venues that they're performing at, they would prefer them mount the Mikado, some of them. But otherwise, they've been offering Pirates of Penzance as an alternative.
Right.
So there are venues that are asking for this Mikado.
Yes.
And so, do you decide to add your voice to the blog post? And you wrote it the day that, right after.
Right, like the day.
They canceled it. Because you were saying, I mean, the cancellation wasn't the point of your piece. There was more to say about it, because I think people were confused about why it was wrong and why.
Exactly. Because
what the issues were.
Right. The artistic director of NY Gasp said that we talked to artists beforehand and we determined that yellow face makeup was wrong. And so we did not do that, but we wanted to retain the costumes and props of our original production. And so from that, I was thinking about the concept of yellow face and why makeup is not okay, but clothing and ethnic regalia is. And so based on that and based on seeing Cry Trojans by the Rooster Group earlier this year, where they reset Troilus and Cressida as Native American in intertribal warfare with an almost all white cast, I thought, why does no one understand that it's not face painting is not the problem, it's the appropriation factor. And so I wrote an op-ed laying out what appropriation is.
Right.
Do not read the comments if you read the article, because it will kill your soul.
The Facebook comments, I thought, were more varied, and there were some interesting points there, right? Because,
Definitely. There are interesting points made about if you're a community production or if you're a high school production and you want to put on these classics like Mikado, King and I, you know, things that have been seen as problematic by a lot of people. It's an education thing. So shouldn't you be allowed to do it? And I have no problems with educational amateur productions because most of the time no one's getting paid anyway. And
it's not taking work away from qualified Asian
and
performers.
And I mean, I had an interview with, this is a sort of around the same topics, with Stephen Adley Gurgis last year talking about his plays, you know, The Motherfucker with the Hat.
Yes,
and
in Connecticut.
There was a big controversy in Connecticut. But then, you know, his play, I believe it got done in Finland.
Yeah.
And he went to see it. And, you know, there was nary a person of color in that cast. And, you know, it didn't upset him as much because there wasn't access to those performers.
Right.
But in Connecticut, there was. So it was like, if you have access and there is a community of performers that fits the right culture for this production,
It's not just the performers, but also the audience. Like,
yeah.
if there were an audience, let's just someone to put up the hypothetical. So wait, can Japanese people do Sound of Music? It's like, yes, they can do Sound of Music, but if there had been it was a tortured analogy, but there's no direct analogy for the Mikado, which was written by Gilbert and Sullivan, and you know, who had very little contact with actual Japanese culture. and who just used it as a sort of fantasy world called Titty Poo to critique
Victorian
their own society. Yeah, and, you know, and as many people point out, also to critique the British Empire. So it was pretty irreverent satire for its day. But, you know, A, it's not satirizing anything that's currently relevant to us. And if you're going to still do it today, I think it is offensive. It's offensive not just for Asian Americans, but anyone to watch people pretend
but
to Dee be.
But Dee also pointed out in her editorial, like, Asian ways that it has been reconceived, like the Hypocrite's Mikado or something like that.
Right. Or Mu Performing Arts did with an Asian cast.
Exactly. Because there's the biggest argument that I've heard is because it's traditionally been done this way, we should preserve it in the name of historical accuracy. But then people reconceive Shakespeare all the time, and people reconceive all kinds of classics in different ways. Why are racist works that were considered racist in their days? Works like, I'm going to go into opera now because that's the topic, that's been a hot topic. Like, why something like Othello, why doesn't it need to be formed with black face paint? Just because it's been traditionally performed that way. There's no need for you to turn this character into an African American man when you can just play him as a white man and it will still get the exact same point across. So we don't need to be reverent towards theater. It's a living, dynamic art form, and if we don't change it, that's how theater dies.
Right.
I mean, it's like Trevor Nunn's argument that Shakespeare should be done by all white performers, right?
Well, that wasn't his argument. Exactly.
Not argument, but like his defense of his show.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I'm not going to defend Trevor Nunn. His idea was that because it was a big, complicated cast of lots of people, he wanted historical accuracy of not how it was done, but, you know, historical accuracy
of the
period, which is a little silly, but
you can have historical accuracy without having all white actors.
Yeah. That's true. Well, so anyway, if
people of color did not exist before 1800.
Spoiler alert: they did.
They did. They did. So yeah, it's a lively discussion, which you can see on our website on all these exciting issues. And I think now we were going to want to go to our explosive disgraced package. I don't think we've teased that well enough earlier on.
Yeah, so we have a great, since Disgraced is our number one play with, I believe, 18 productions over the next 12 months. And
I had said 40. If
40 if you over the next 18 months, I said. And if you go out of theaters that aren't just TCG members. So I think we did this last year when Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike was our top 10. We do an interview with the playwright and then a roundtable of critics from different cities who've seen it. I'll talk about the interview and Rob can talk about the roundtable. Ayad Akhtar came to our offices and we had a lively discussion with him about all the productions, about how his play, which if you haven't seen it, is quite an explosive portrait of just modern life in America. It explores a lot of themes, including religion and wealth and art and appropriation a little bit. No,
there's definitely some appropriation going on.
There's definitely some, a little bit.
I don't know.
It's very interesting. It won the Pulitzer. It's the first play he ever wrote. I mean, he was an actor and a screenwriter before, and it won the Pulitzer in 2013. And he talked with us about a lot of things and got very passionate about several issues and has a lot of good things to say.
We look forward to that. And then after that, we'll just go straight into it. We've got Charles Isherwood from the New York Times and Chris Jones from the Chicago Tribune talking about, between them, a total of 4 productions of Disgrace that they've variously seen. All the same production by Kimberly Senior with different cast, but it's a play we published in our July-August 2013 issue, and it's been discussed a lot, and we're going to discuss it some more. It's going to be produced all over the country starting very soon. So
it's at the Goodman Theater in Chicago right now.
That's where Chris saw it. So listen in.
Well, thank you for joining us for American Theater's Offscript. We're here with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Ayad Akhtar, author of Disgrace, the number one most produced play across the United States for the 2015-16 season. Congratulations, Ayad.
Thank you so much. I didn't realize that was the case. It's kind of amazing. So.
Yeah, how does it feel to have the most produced play?
Great. I mean, you know, there's a lot of interpretations out there. Let's put it that way.
Totally, totally. And I mean, many of our listeners may not have seen Disgrace. It's played in Chicago at the American Theater Company where it started, and then it transferred to Lincoln Center off Broadway, and then it played on Broadway in the 2014-15 season, and next it's going to the Goodman Theater in Chicago. But for our listeners who haven't seen it, could you give a little synopsis of what it's about and also what inspired you to write the play?
Well, Disgraced is basically about a Muslim American corporate attorney who has been sort of, you know, hiding his Muslim origins from his Jewish bosses at work. And over the course of the play, that comes out. And, you know, the centerpiece of the play is a third scene, which is a long dinner party scene where he gets too drunk. And it's been a bad day at work where it's pretty clear that he's on his way out. And his life basically unravels.
That's a good synopsis without giving anything away. And what inspired you to write Disgraced? Where did you get the idea for the play?
You know, I don't know, actually. I mean, I feel like I've answered that question so many different ways because I'm actually not really sure. I know that in a way I think it was probably, you know, I often say that a good idea for a story is not just one idea. It's three or four ideas that come together. And so I think that any one of those three or four ideas would be a good story as to where it came from. But why those things came together at the time that they did, I think had a lot to do with my own development as a writer, as an artist. And I think I really kind of came of age late. I've been doing this a very long time, and I don't think I came to my subject matter or to my own voice until I was, I'd been doing this 20 years.
Totally. And I mean, you had three plays produced in New York, I think all within the same year, but Disgrace was the first one to be produced here. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I had Disgrace produced in, late 2012.
Okay.
And then at Lincoln Center again, the Who and the What, it, was, summer 2014. Then Disgrace on Broadway, fall of 2014, and then The Invisible Hand at New York Theater Workshop in winter of 2014.
Yeah.
So it was a lot.
First three plays all in a quick succession.
Unbelievable, yeah. And it was tough. It was like running a marathon, and you know, we started rehearsals at New York Theater Workshop a day before we opened on Broadway, and facing the critics and three times in New York in 6 months, that's a gut check.
Yeah. Totally.
And, you know, I'm not sure I passed it. My agent said to me, I don't know that, I don't know anybody who's dealt with this process as poorly as you have.
Oh, no.
He said that lovingly.
So how do
My lawyer said the same thing. He said, I've repped them all, Ad, and I really have never seen anyone in such a poor state.
Oh, no. So are you doing okay knowing that Disgrace is going to like every theater across America?
You know, you keep reminding me of it, and I think that if I was doing okay, I'm not so sure I am anymore.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the play, because it started in Chicago, and then it moved to New York, and now it's going to various cities, starting again in Chicago. Have there been different receptions of the play based on the city you were in, like Midwest versus New York?
Yeah, London, and it was in London, too.
You had a production in London as well.
Yeah, I think there have been different responses. I mean, I feel like, you know, some of that's the production. I think much of that is a mirror. Every time a new actor steps into that role, it becomes a completely different play. And I feel like the play confuses audiences, basically. Fundamentally, it's a confusing play.
Yeah.
It's a disorienting play, and it's not as advertised. It's advertised as something that it ends up not being. And so that's something I have to constantly deal with as a writer, is that I am being confronted by an audience that had an expectation that it was going to be something that I always knew it was not going to be. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I don't think that was different in Chicago or different in New York or different in London or different anywhere. I think that often there's a certain kind of viewer who connects very deeply to the play and who sees the play as something that is illuminating about their own experience. I think that people who try to come to understand what's going on in those guys' heads, those Muslims, I think leave very disoriented.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I did a piece, for The Economist recently where, I think I put it better than I'd ever put it before, which is that I think one of the paradoxes of all my work is that it's addressed to two audiences, and those audiences don't overlap. So there's the Muslim audience worldwide. I mean, I think in a way, and certainly The Who and the What, which is a delightful family comedy, would set most would set most of the theaters on fire if it was ever done in the Arab world or in the Muslim world. You couldn't do it. You know, it would be blasphemy of the highest order, even though it's done in this very delightful sort of all in the family meets whatever. And I think with Disgrace, similarly, you can't, you couldn't, you know, Amir couldn't say the things that he says on stage without, without inflaming serious social unrest. So the plays exist to be seen by an audience that never sees them.
Totally.
And so the audience that sees them is the, is an audience that it's, they're also addressed to. But the, at least in Disgrace, the attack is just as strong on that audience as it is on, but it's very easy, I think, for a non-Muslim audience to say, oh, well, this is about Muslims, unless they're willing to really engage the play. And if they are, then I think my experience has been that they have had very meaningful experiences. I think one of the paradoxes also of Disgrace is that it's really not a literary play in many ways. It's a, it's an entertainment. It's a, it's agitprop. It's agitprop meets tragedy meets, and it's very, it's in dialogue with the audience. It's not in dialogue with the tradition. And so, the fact that, you know, you have laughs at this point and that point and that point, and then there's a gasp and then there's a pause and then there's another laugh. All of that's part of the architecture of the work that's much closer to a Neil Simon sensibility than it is, say, to Beckett or Pinter or whatever you may, whatever you may have. And so I think that creates another disjuncture for the audience because it's not as advertised.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the whole notion of, and all of that exacerbated by the fact that there are really no prominent Muslim voices in this country writing in any form.
Yeah.
And so suddenly somebody gets elevated into something of a kind of mainstream. Well, that person is seen as, well, of course, this person's going to finally tell us why these people are good. And here I am criticizing my own community. So what's that all about?
I have about 100 follow-up questions to what you just said, but I want to start with your Economist piece that you mentioned. You mentioned in that piece as well that the Muslim Americans who have seen it, some of them have had a negative response to the play.
Oh, many of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has that been difficult for you to have?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I have a friend of mine who, he's a, he was in The Invisible Hand. He's a neurologist who, works during the day, at the hospital, and he acts at night because he loves to act. He's from Pakistan, and he was born here like myself, but he's from Pakistan, Pakistani origin. He is inclined more than anybody to like my work, right? I mean, he was in a play of mine, so, and he, I would imagine, would, you know, he went and saw The Who and the What in Chicago, and he said, I couldn't believe how defensive I got and how angry you made me. I mean, you're sitting there telling me that the reason that our women wear veils is because the prophet wanted to sleep with his stepdaughter's wife. Who do you think you are? How can you say things like that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can say them because they need to be said and because that's the job of the artist. But I think that when a community is not used to seeing itself represented on stage or when it's not used to seeing itself represented in the media, you know, I asked him, I said, you like it when Italian Americans make fun of themselves and call themselves out and air their dirty laundry. You feel identified with them. You feel that there's pleasure that you get from that. You don't think those dirty Guidos. You think how human, right?
Yeah.
He said, yeah. I said, well, the same white audience, the non-Muslim audience feels the same about this family. Right? He says, really? I don't think so. I think they're laughing at us. I said, no, they're laughing with us just as we are laughing with others. So I think when a community does not have the experience of being represented, there's a, is an inherent defensiveness.
Yeah.
You know, and you saw it, one saw it in the work of the reception of Philip Roth's work early on, and this is what's good for the Jews, what's bad for the Jews post-Holocaust, post, you know, emigration of the Jewry, the European Jewry to the United States, and the possibility that something like that might happen again. And how, where is Philip Roth is talking about how these Jewish characters masturbate into livers behind, behind billboards? Like,
yeah.
What are you doing? You know? So I don't know. It's a, it's one of those things. I've always felt like, I take myself to task as much as anybody else. It is my job to give pleasure. It's my job to be guided by a pursuit of the truth, as Horace says, to delight and instruct. that's my mandate. That's what I try to do. But I think that my community is not ready for the most part. And I think it's going to take another generation. It's going to take a generation having seen that there are people like myself who found a way to make a living, to have an impact, that their parents can encourage them to pursue things that are not about survival, and that higher questions about identity, about the meaning of life as expressed through the process of art, can actually take root in the community. It's just something that is not part of the community that I come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another follow-up to that, as you mentioned, the play is for two audiences, the Muslim American audiences, many of whom...
No, Muslim audience around the world.
Muslim audience around the world, and the Muslim Americans in the U.S. who have gotten to see it. And then also the non-Muslim, you know, white audience. Are you concerned at all with the play kind of going around the country to different theaters, that the maybe the negative portrayal of Muslim Americans that the play has will reinforce certain stereotypes people have?
I mean, you know, it's just like... A white writer writes an anti-hero and they're celebrated. A colored writer writes an anti-hero and they're writing a stereotype. It's absurd. You know, and it's, and the question provokes an animus in me because I'm so sick and tired of it.
Yeah.
It's a misunderstanding of the very nature of what art is. Art is not an advertisement. Mm-hmm. It's not a commercial. We're not engaged in the business of PR.
Yeah.
But it speaks to the denatured environment that we exist in, that art's only economic utility is seen as such. That's not what I do. Mm-hmm. And I don't know who would be interested in a play about a group of people who are not real and who are not flawed. Mm-hmm. But the simple fact that any of these characters is flawed becomes the beginning of making a case against Muslim Americans and against me. Mm-hmm. I can deal with it. It's fine. At the end of the day, this is the job, the nature of what it is to do what I do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that I have borne graciously with this line of thinking for a long time. And I think I've gotten to a point where I really can't anymore.
Totally. I mean, that leads into a question. I don't know if you heard about fabulous writer A. Ray Pamatmat, who wrote Edith Can Shoot Things and Hit Them, and it was done in a production up at Company One in Boston, and one of the reviewers wrote a review about how he was very concerned that characters never drew attention to their Filipino-American heritage, even though that was nothing that the play was about. It was about these kids living on their own, but the reviewer made it about race because the playwright was Filipino-American. Mm-hmm. And you've said about your plays that these are plays about America. This is an American family. I think sure. You said that in the Economist story or the Washington Post story I read about you.
Right.
But people, do you feel like people ask questions about that or make your plays about that?
Let's not pretend that I'm sitting here because I'm sitting here in part because that's what people are asking. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a paucity of voices addressing the experience that I'm writing about. And I think people understandably have a hunger to understand and to know more. I think that, again, it is not the job of the artist to do that. I mean, I think that some would say that the purpose of art is to expand the birth of empathy in the audience. And, you know, I think that that's true. How one goes about doing that is, I think, up to the person who's doing it. And I don't have a problem with people asking me questions that I don't think are appropriate, as long as they're okay with me giving them the answer that I think is appropriate to the inappropriate question. I think it's great that people ask me the questions they do, but, you know, I'm not particularly interested. Here's a really good example, and it's sort of far afield, but, you know, I get asked a lot about Islam and violence and the Quran and whatnot. And is ISIS and this and what have you and all that kind of stuff. And my response immediately, I mean, it's to say the global geopolitical situation we are existing in is actually our creation. Mm-hmm. We created it. But how much time do we spend as Americans talking about the fact that we, Bush, idiot king number one, who went into a foreign land and under false pretenses invaded, mm-hmm. occupied, and on day one of the occupation released 80,000 enemy soldiers into the hinterlands. And then 2 years later complains about an insurgency. Where's the insurgency? Well, what do you think is going to happen when you release 80,000 soldiers unpaid into the hinterlands? And then puts them back on payroll and calls it an awakening.
Oh, gosh.
And then the insurgency is gone. And once the insurgency is gone, takes them off payroll again. And now puts somebody else in charge, Nouri al-Maliki, who systematically starts murdering all those guys. So what are they going to do? The insurgency is back and it's got a new name. Where does it come from? Does it come from the Quran? Does it come from Islam? What kind of a dumb fucking question is that? The question is predicated on an absolute incapacity to actually ask the question of ourselves. And I am supposed to address this?
Yeah.
The absurdity of it is, I mean, it's a tautology. And so to address, I am writing about all of it. Yes, I'm disgraced in many ways is about constellating the very tribalism in the audience that they see on stage. And for the audience to then be confronted with that experience. I do not want to resolve it. There's nothing to resolve.
Yeah.
But because it's about Islam, the audience can walk away from the play. And then they can begin to draw their own conclusions. And often some of those conclusions, if they hate Muslims, the play gives them the freedom to hate them. I'm not trying to make them like Muslims. I don't care whether they like Muslims. I like Muslims and I hate Muslims. I like myself and I hate myself. That's the human experience.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to capture.
That's a great answer. I think you said in another interview that about, you know, art's ability to change and, you know, make progress in the world. It's not great, but it can change the individual perspective, which I think is a really interesting about what you're doing, what you're saying about the tribalism of people. Like, we all have tribal nature and human nature, and there's a dichotomy in all of us. And so that's an interesting perspective. I also want to talk about your collaboration on the play with Kimberly Senior, who's directed at American Theater Company at Lincoln Center on Broadway. She's doing it at the Goodman. She's doing it, I believe, at Berkeley Rep, Seattle Rep, Center Theater Group. What has it been like working with the same director on so many productions?
It's been great. I mean, there's been a consistency of approach in terms of understanding that the play is not a play of ideas, that the play is a tool for audience engagement, that it's an entertainment, if you will, which is paradoxical to say because it's structured as a tragedy. But the play functions beat to beat like a live performance. It's not if you approach it as a blueprint of a world that exists that we're going to try to recreate, there are inconsistencies in it. There are inconsistencies in the way that things are written, that the only way they work and are made whole is by the experience of sharing it with an audience. And so I think that's a very difficult thing for people to understand when directors, especially when directors look at it, they try to make sense of who these characters are. Well, the characters are not separate from the experience the audience is having of them. And so there is backstory, there is character, there are character traits, all of that, but it's not a traditional realistic mimesis of an alternative world that is then being presented in a with formal. I think that Disgraced is not a naturalistic play that's depicting a naturalistic world with certain formal concessions. Having to do with dramatic efficiency, impact, and all of that. It really is a formal experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess in that way, I think resembles a more classical approach to the making of theater, whether it's, you know, something as old as Aeschylus or Sophocles or Shakespeare or whatever, that their form comes first. It's not a naturalistic depiction, even though it's sitting in a kind of naturalistic universe.
Totally. And I mean, you're going to Chicago to work on this production rehearsal?
Just to see it. No. They're already in previews.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Started 2 days ago.
So no more changes to the play?
No.
But you did mention that Chris Jones, the critic in Chicago, who reviewed it first at the American Theater Company, kind of started the love of the play. How did that kind of come about?
Well, he wrote this review that was just unbelievable. I mean, it was like comparing it to Mammoth and different stuff. And then suddenly everybody wanted to do the play. You know what I mean? It's like, how does that happen? It's like all of a sudden. You know, and he, you know, it was a wonderful, you know, wonderful review. And it was also, I thought a very astute review, because there were some criticisms in the review that I think helped to, help me to see some things that needed work. And it was a beautiful experience to have a review that could move my career and the play forward, and at the same time move me forward as an artist in terms of, developing my craft. I think, you know, I'm very grateful for that review.
Yeah. Does it feel nice to be returning to Chicago now?
Yeah.
Since that's where it started?
Yeah, it does. It feels great.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. And I mean, you talked a little bit a few questions ago about the form of the play. And I think it's interesting. I was thinking about this. It is a New York living room play.
Totally.
Which is kind of one of the most popular forms of writers of all kinds in the American theater. How did you choose this form to tell this story?
You know, I think I always wanted, I had a kind of obsession with mid Woody Allen in my 20s, meaning mid career Woody Allen, everything from, say, Love and Death to Husbands and Wives, everything pre Sun Yi and post Sleeper Banana period. I always wanted to write a play or a story, a movie or something in which characters say incredibly intelligent things and really elegant Upper East Side interiors as they sip fine beverages.
It's my favorite kind of play.
You know what I mean? Like, I would love to be one of those people, like all these beautiful people. Like,
you wonder what a Nancy Meyers film on stage.
Exactly. Woody Allen.
Woody Allen.
A mid Woody Allen film.
Nancy Meyers has pretty good interior decorations in her film.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's true. And so, and I think that, you know, the idea of keeping it all in one location. I mean, I really subscribe to the belief that, if you can preserve the unity of setting, the unity of time, and the unity of action, like Aristotle suggests that one should attempt to do, that you have created, I think, probably the most potent form of theatrical investment that the audience can make, because they can feel nested in the environment that can begin to transform by itself. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think in some ways I'm always hoping that I can do that. I have a new play which is attempting to do that by setting it on a stage, in a sense, Shakespearean, in the sense that, you know, the Globe Theater is actually the setting for most of Shakespeare's plays. Mm-hmm. And the audience is nested in the experience of that, which is what makes those Rylands productions so powerful. Because we sense we can invest in the enduring nature of this space that is unchanging. Mm-hmm. And everything that happens in this space, well, that's representational. There's mimesis there, but there's a holding, a container for the experience of the audience. And I think if you can contain the audience that way over 2 hours or 90 minutes or whatever is without, it's like moving. You know, moving is the most anxious thing that you can do other than whatever, getting divorced or dying or whatever they say. It's like, right? And I think the same thing holds true for an audience, that if you move the audience from one space to the other, there is this shiver of anxiety that can rupture the suspension of disbelief. And how you handle that, Brecht handled it in one way with the curtain and the setting of the theater. And naturalistic American drama at its best tends to deal with it in a different way. All My Sons, whatever, what have you. You know, so first act break, second act break. It's an enduring feature, I think, of the theater, especially the proscenium stage. And it's one of the, this is probably an answer that's gone on too long, but yes, that was the thinking behind it.
No, I mean, I love New York living room plays, and we actually did a whole piece in American Theater about the different types of evolving living room plays that have come around. I mean, I don't know, this might be a completely unfounded statement, but I've, you know, not everyone who lives across America lives in New York or in a New York apartment. And so it's interesting that a play set in an apartment on the Upper East Side is going to be playing in, you know, Seattle and Berkeley and Chicago and people who...
New Mexico. Miami. Louisiana. Austin, Texas.
Do you know all the
Cincinnati,
cities?
Cincinnati. St. Louis. Denver. I mean, it just keeps going.
Los Angeles.
Atlanta. Los Angeles. Sacramento.
Are you going to be able to go to all these cities?
Are you crazy?
Are you going to get to go to some?
I mean, I'm going to go to Berkeley.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's a lot. I got a lot to do, and I'm very fortunate that I have things to do right now, and I think I need to attend to them.
Yeah. You mentioned you have a new play. Is that
I do. It's going up at La Jolla Playhouse in July 2016.
That's exciting.
It's three acts, 25 characters, 175 pages.
25 actors too?
17 actors probably.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you can write bigger plays now that you've gotten some success?
I certainly felt I could write one bigger play. We'll see how that works out for me.
How long does it take you to write a play? It seems like with three plays in a row in New York, you write pretty quickly.
I can. It depends on my prep. It depends on how well I prepare. Like, so for example, this new play, I had the idea. It had been kicking around some idea about writing about the financial world in a comprehensive way. And then I, in February 2013, I had the idea of how to do it. And then I spent, starting April, I think I spent 10 months preparing, sort of doing research, mapping it out. And then I went to Yaddo for 6 weeks, sat down on the second day, started on page one. And then by the end of my residency in 6 weeks, I had a 180 page play. So that was my first draft. But that was the prep, you know, it was 10 months of prep and then go, just do it.
So you got to know your story and your characters and your themes really well. And then
I have to know everything well enough to be surprised along the way.
Yeah.
To understand how to be surprised.
Yeah. Because you've written screenplays as well. And it's a different process. I feel like that you have to be a little bit more organized with an outline and
exactly.
Get that done. But your play needs to surprise you as you're writing it.
They do. But of course, as you well know, I mean, my narratives are extremely, they're narrative universes and they're narrative stories. And so they're very tightly constructed in terms of their plotting. And all of that comes from screenwriting.
Yeah. Without asking explicitly about the topic of the reveal and disgrace, did you know that was going to happen when you started writing it?
I did not.
You did not?
I did not.
I don't want to spoil it for listeners. There's a big event that happens at the end of the third scene.
Well, I didn't know. And I actually, midway through the third scene, he says something, mm-hmm. which I didn't know he was going to say either.
And that kind of switched it in your brain?
It just happened.
Oh, wow.
That's
fascinating.
Yeah. And actually, I'd gotten toward the end of the third scene and I was stuck. And I realized I had resistance to what was coming up. So then one day I just let it happen and I was like, I can't believe that this is not right. Like, I can't do this. This feels awful. I hate this. But it was so clear that this is what he did. And it felt like a real crossing for me as an artist. Like I had touched a whole different level of my own voice by allowing that to happen.
That's so interesting. This was the first play you wrote, right?
It was, yeah.
My gosh, win the Pulitzer for your first play and
hey,
have it tour across the country.
I just tried to write as good a play as I could, and I just keep trying to do the same thing.
Yeah. One thing that was interesting you said, I saw your TEDx Broadway talk, which I really enjoyed. It was so poetic and wonderful. But you talked a lot about the tyranny of the image, the regime of the image, about how audiences and people today's entertainment ADD and
– right.
Do you feel like, is there a future for live theater? Are cell phones populating the theater?
Well, I think that's exactly what I was saying, is that nothing will ever render the theater obsolete because of the very nature of its, the fact that it is about presence, that it is not a simulation of relationship. It is relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no way it's going to disappear. The question of the monetization of theater will be an enduring problem. As I mentioned in that talk, mm-hmm. by its nature, it resists monetization. It only happens here. It only happens now. It cannot be reproduced. And so there's inherent limitations of space and presence that just make it hard and make it hard economically.
Yeah.
That's its, it's the unfortunate reality, but it's also the saving grace, is that it resists that. The magic is always possible. I'm not saying the magic always happens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that we've all recognized that going to bad theater is something that happens more than it should, and that makes it very difficult for us to explain to other people why we're still involved in this. Mm-hmm. Because they also go to bad theater a lot and they're like, well, who the hell cares about this stupid thing? Mm-hmm. But at its best, there's nothing like it.
Yeah. So, did you grow up with the theater, in the theater?
Nah, not really.
Just came to it.
Came to it in college.
Nice.
That thing that happens sometimes.
Spark of inspiration. But you started out acting with film and...
I was acting in college and, doing that sort of thing. So.
Cool. I was just curious.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ayad. And you can watch his TEDx Broadway talk on YouTube, or Disgraced is probably coming to a theater near you sometime this year.
If you're in Albuquerque or Phoenix or Tucson or Sacramento or San Diego or Los Angeles.
Or somewhere that you could probably travel to
or
on
Portland,
the cheap.
Or Seattle or Chicago or Minnesota, Minneapolis.
How many productions are there this year?
I think within the next 18 months, I think there's over 40.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So Arkansas, is it Arkansas? No, Arkansas is not doing it. So Arkansas is the one state that I don't believe is. Maybe Tennessee is also not doing it. So.
Well, Disgraced is coming to a theater near you. And I feel like I'm publicizing a movie, but it's playing at that many theaters that this is correct. Thanks, Ayad. And thanks for joining us.
Welcome for a discussion of Disgraced. I'm here with Charles Isherwood of the New York Times. Hello, Charles.
Hi, Rob.
And with Chris Jones of the Chicago Tribune. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Rob.
Disgraced, as we published last week, is going to be the most produced play at theaters across the country, both TCG and otherwise, in the coming season. Do you think it deserves to be the most produced play in the coming season, Chris?
Well, does any play deserve to be the most produced play in the coming season? It's a very good play. It's a very good play. I have no problem with it being the most produced play in the coming season. I can kind of have a sense of why it is, I think.
It's almost surprising that it wasn't like last year, because I think it was, I guess it's not surprising because last year is when it was on Broadway and that's when it became to greater attention. But we published it in May, June of 2013, and it was, of course, it debuted at American Theater. What was that year, or 2012? 2012. I mean, it seems like the things that makes it, that you would think make it relevant and timely and the thing, kind of thing people would want to produce all over the country would have been true a couple years ago, but I guess it might take a Broadway production. Charles, what do you think?
Well, I think the Broadway producers wrapped up the rights.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Basically forbade anyone from doing it if they had plans to bring it to Broadway. So that's why it took a year to get to the regionals. That's my assumption anyway.
The production that just opened in Chicago is one of only two other ones outside Chicago so far. I guess there's Playmakers in Chapel Hill, North Carolina just opened their production as well. But I think that's it. But then it's going to start to roll out all over the country throughout the coming season. Chris, I don't know, Charles, did you see the American Theater production in Chicago originally?
No, I didn't actually. I didn't see it until it came to the LCT3 program here.
Right, right. So, Chris, take us back to that production in 2012 at American Theater. Your review was a rave, I would say.
Of the original? Yeah, I thought it was a very stimulating new play. It already had the Araka group, so it already had kind of commercial producers attached to it. And Ayad Akhtar, Ayad's new book, American Dervish, had just come out, actually. I think it came out right very close to when that play premiered in Chicago. And that novel was sort of making some waves, as well. It was reviewed very favorably in the New York Times, I remember. And so he was kind of, 2012, he kind of became, he went from no one knowing his name hardly at all to being a novelist and a playwright who people knew. And the play, changed somewhat between, I didn't see the one that Charles saw at Lincoln Center. I saw it again on Broadway. So I saw the original and I saw it on Broadway. And the play had improved. I think if I'm remembering right, at the end of the play in the first production, it was a bit like the picture of Dorian Gray. It was a much more sort of sort of melodramatic arc in the play, and the play was kind of made more subtle and it calmed down a bit, and it's still a very exciting play. So I think it greatly improved between Chicago and New York, which is the way these things are supposed to go, and it kind of went that way.
Yeah, I think scene four in the interview we ran with the play was the one that changed the most, because he didn't know what to do after the climactic act of violence, to follow that. And Charles, by the time you saw it, I think it was in the form. It didn't change too much from the time you saw it at Lincoln Center to Broadway, or did it?
No, it really didn't. Obviously, they recast three of the four actors, or three of the five actors. But it was still essentially the same very powerful play. And I think what's interesting is it's even more relevant now than it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago whenever it debuted, because we have seen how Muslims, you know, seemingly assimilated, have become radicalized out of the blue. Nobody knows why this is happening, but it's a real phenomenon.
Right. So you think, yeah, that was definitely something people were thinking about a lot in 2012, but you think even more so now?
Well, much more so now. I mean, I don't think ISIS was really on the radar in 2011 so much. But now we see this is happening in European countries and in America, and the play addresses that issue of how Muslims who are seemingly assimilated suddenly reveal other layers,
right?
You know, and we don't really know, you know, people's identities are in flux all the time.
And you're talking mostly about there's this explicit case of his nephew who seems to be,
but also Amir himself.
That's true. I'm wondering if, Chris, if you felt like whether it's relevant, more relevant now or not, do you feel like your perception of the play has changed? You've told me it's the same director in all these productions and different actors, and mostly different actors in all of them, but you feel like it's the same experience of a play for you, or has something deepened or changed?
Well, I agree with Charles that the play feels relevant. I think the ISIS issue is true. I think the play does feel more relevant now in many ways. I was struck with this most recent production I saw with an older actor closer to my own age playing the central character. The character in the original production I saw was in his early 30s. This guy plays more. Sort of mid-40s, late-40s, and that deepens the production a little bit because, you know, his fall, I think Akhtar was trying to write, pretentious as it may sound, he was trying to write an American tragedy, and I think the fall of that character when you had somewhat older actor in that role feels all the greater. On the other hand, I also thought that, you know, I had a bit of a response of like, well, you'd think he'd figured out who he was by now.
Right.
So like a lot of plays, the nuance of the play definitely changes with the actors. I mean, I think it's one of the things I like about the play is it's very difficult in what is basically an 80-minute play to go from like 0 to 90 miles an hour in the way that he quite skillfully does in this play, where you've got it's a perfectly ordinary day at the beginning of the play in a marriage, perfectly ordinary. Uh-huh. You know, he's sitting there, she's sitting there, and by the end of the play, they're literally peeling each other off the walls, and it remains a credible fight. You know, to anybody who's married or in a long-term relationship, you know, you sort of the elements of the fight are recognizable. So I think it's a very deftly structured play, which I think is a lot of the reason people are wanting to do it. It's some of the people around my newspaper who don't go to the theater very much have wandered in to tell me that they saw it, and a lot of them say they were exhausted by it, or that it was, it was a very draining play. And so, I mean, it's definitely a play that is accessible for people, and it's a very slick commercial play. It reminds me in some ways of God of Carnage with more depth, you know,
oh,
and with
sure.
more. And so I think it's no surprise to me that everybody's doing it.
Hmm. Yeah. There's something about I didn't see it anywhere except on Broadway, but I'd read it. And one thing is, I wasn't exhausted by the play, but there was a sort of tension in the audience that I haven't felt at a Broadway play I don't normally feel at a Broadway play. There was a certain on tenterhooks feel to the audience's reaction to, I think, not even just to the climactic violence, but to sort of Amir's character and what he's saying. about Muslims and the fact that it's coming from an ostensibly Muslim American person. And I know anecdotally that if I didn't see, I wasn't in an audience when this happened, but I think when his partner's Jewish husband calls him an animal near the end of the show, this isn't a spoiler for anyone, that apparently someone in the audience echoed that later after, you know, just said it out loud. Your feeling about that, I think it's sort of an interesting, he's talked about how the violence and Amir's, the way Amir talks about Islam is sort of mirroring Islamophobic tropes. And I'm just wondering as if one of the keys to this play's popularity is not just topicality, but the way that it can sort of maybe like a Trojan horse go into America and say all the things that are on some people's minds, or that Ben Carson talking about Muslims. I wonder if you talk about that, the way the play is sort of, you feel like it's worked for those kind of audiences, and if you think it's going to continue to raise those issues for audiences.
Well, I would say, I mean, it is kind of shocking, some of his language. He calls it the Quran, one very long hate letter to humanity at one point, which I think kind of echoes what, you know, we assume about the Quran, and nobody's really read it, these audiences, I mean. But I think what's interesting is that character then turns around and reveals other layers. So we don't really, the assumptions we make about him at the beginning of the play are not the ones, obviously, we come away with. But I do think it's important that people, you know, see these sort of obvious, as you say, tropes about Islamism sort of undermined by the other characters.
Right.
I mean, he's the one in the beginning who is, you know, attacking Islam, and everyone else is defending it very intelligently. And what is exciting about the play is that debate.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think there's no question that Ayad Akhtar is a controversial writer within the Pakistani American community and within the Muslim community in America in general. When his novel came out, I ended up doing a public conversation with him, and the front row was mighty hostile to him. I remember his head coming out of the, and you know, there's definitely a feeling that he airs some dirty laundry that not everybody in that community really wants to air. And you know, all of his plays are that way. There was the play The Who and the What here in Chicago, at Victory Gardens here in Chicago, another of his plays that is really even more sort of controversial within that community, and there's been some fallout from that too. He is, you know, I think he's aware of that. The play is a sort of a edgy play. It's not, he's not a politically correct writer. He doesn't sort of articulate what everybody expects him to articulate. He's a playwright. He's writing sort of, you know, edgy material. It's very, very well thought through. But it's not without controversy. No question about that.
Well, I agree in general. I do think that, you know, it's interesting that, I mean, the play's appeal has a lot to do with also the fact that, you know, you have this classic domestic setup.
Yeah.
Know, for theaters, you've got five characters, one set.
Yeah.
Has a lot to do with why it's spreading out across the country, of course. But I do think it really does, you know, address issues that people are really thinking about right now in a sophisticated way. I mean, it, you know, it does border on melodrama at times, but, right. You know, yeah, in 90 minutes, he packs a lot of stuff in there, a lot of thought, a lot of action, a lot of, you know, reflectiveness.
I guess the better way to phrase the question, since you brought up American Dervish and the reaction of the Pakistani American community, Chris, is just, you know, I think that the criticism, and this isn't necessarily his fault, that he's successful in the mainstream in part. You see this sometimes with minority artists who tell the ostensibly on the surface tell the mainstream what they want to hear about that minority community. In this case, you know, you have an intelligent Muslim American who's saying the worst possible things about Muslims, and then acts out a trope. Obviously, as we've said, the play works on other levels and is revealing other things. I guess when contemplating the moment in which Ayad Akhtar's play goes all over the country, I imagine these conversations will be on both sides will be very lively.
I understand sort of what you're saying. I think this play is sincerely meant. Like I honestly think that he's writing this play to reflect, really, you know, himself to some degree. He has a complicated and ambivalent relationship with Islam,
right.
And with indeed all of that represents. He's a secularist. He's a that's sort of where he is. On the other hand, he recognizes and I think is haunted by his obligations to his community. He's no different in that from many other groups that we could think of. And I think that it is the play is an attempt to sort of work, you know, to sort of work that out, to say, and I don't think the play really takes a stand either way. I think you can watch that play and go, well, at the end of the day, this guy's problem is that the central character I'm talking about, his problem is that he doesn't pay homage to where he's from, and that in the end he's, you know, he plays the sort of white game and law firms and all that, and it's all ultimately they're going to get him in the end, and they get him.
Yeah.
And if he only, you know, connected himself to who he really was, sort of like in an similar to August Wilson's dominant message, right? That you've got to connect to who you are and know where you're from and right. Pay homage to those who've gone before you. And you can argue that's his tragedy in this play.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, he's also so critical of sort of the ideology of Islam and the sexism of Islam and the violence provoked, but, you know, he's critical at the same time. So he takes on both sides and he sort of hits it down the middle and to some degree is going to irritate both sides in doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Charles, you saw Asif Manvi and Hari Dillon and both of their performances. Did you feel like the version of LCT and this one were remarkably different? I know you said the play didn't change, but Usman Ali and Bernard White certainly, as Chris pointed out, brought different things to the role. Could you talk just about? I mean, you probably wrote about it in your review, but
and I've probably forgotten what I said.
Right, exactly. So I'll quote it back to you. No, I don't have it here. So what?
No, it's fine. No, Asif Manvi, of course, brought a certain sexiness to the play because of his association with the Daily Show. He was very intense,
okay,
and very extroverted in a way. I mean, it was very big performance in a small theater, which made it all the more kind of exciting.
Right.
Hari Dillon, I thought, was really wonderful because you could really see the inner conflicts tearing at him inside. It was very subtle. It was a more subtle performance in a way.
Yeah.
They were both very good. But I do think it's a very interesting character, one of the most interesting we've seen, because he, in the middle of the play, sort of does an about face. Here I am attacking, you know, this faith I was brought up in and pointing out its potential flaws. And then at some point he says, wait a minute, you know, I did feel a tinge of pride on 9/11 when, you know, that tragedy occurred. So it's really quite a fascinating, you know, I wouldn't call it a journey, it's who tried, but
right.
The revelation of the layers of his character, I think, is really where the drama is in this play.
Well, I think, you know, I think Charles is right to bring up sex.
Yeah.
While we're on why this play is so popular, let's say it's because it is kind of a sexy play.
Sure.
I think sex is one of its big themes, sexual attraction and just the whole, you know, and it sort of objectifies the central male character in a way that few plays do. That beginning, that opening scene, he's standing there in his underwear looking really good and,
yeah, that's true.
You know, kind of a hot guy. And it is he needs to be a hot guy for the play to work, and
right.
and there's that question of, you know, opposites attract, and that, you know, that kind of thing, and that there's that whole sort of sexual fervent of the evening. And then the other theme, of course, is booze, that everybody's drinking all the time.
Right.
Well, that's a classic American play thing.
Yeah, that's how I'll be, right?
If you have four characters on stage, three of them have to be drinking.
At least.
So, you know, they're all booze-addled by the end, and that's really how it works. You know, they all get drunk, and when you get drunk, you say things you wouldn't otherwise say. That's kind of the way it works. speaking for myself, that's, you know, and it's like an Edward Albee play that way, definitely. They don't waste any time in it, Rob. You know, it's 80 – I mean, actually, I think it was even a couple of minutes shorter. That was 120. That was, you know, that's a brief, fast-paced piece of theater.
Well, it's a play that thrives on speed because it keeps springing surprises on you, and the faster the surprises come, the more exciting it is in a way.
Right. And do you feel like he nailed that scene for – because I think there's been criticism about that.
This is the very last scene.
The very last scene where the nephew comes, and it is hard to follow that dinner scene. But and it does sort of give some, there doesn't seem to be any hope for the relationship, but does seem some hope that he's going to find himself, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's got, every time I've seen it, that's gotten better. Mm. I mean, still at the end of the play, he's still staring at a picture. There's still something in that I find a slight resistance to that finale. I think it's just...
Oh, really? I think that's a very moving moment, actually.
Oh, there you go. I knew you'd like that.
Well, I mean, it's a picture, you know, he's, the whole play is about who he is. He's staring at this painting and looking into the present, trying to figure out who he is. But anyway, we can disagree about that.
No, it's good to disagree. But it's interesting for all these theaters doing this play is that a lot hangs on that portrait at the end of the play.
That's true.
Number one, it's got to be really good.
Yeah.
And it's got to be of that actor, obviously. It has to change. You've got to have another one if you've got an understudy. And it's got to be a really good, because that really, the climax of the play is when they unwrap that picture. And damn, that better be a good picture. Otherwise, you're in trouble.
Well, and you need a good actor to be reacting to it and transmitting his reactions to the audience.
Right. Yeah, that's a production note for future ones. You got to get a painting. Maybe they could auction the painting to at the end to raise funds. Well, great. I appreciate it. The idea here is, you know, people talk about the plays aren't part of the national conversation, but the idea of getting critics from around the country to talk about these plays, this play will be, if not one conversation, it will be part of the national conversations around the country this in the coming season. And I appreciate you.
Well, it's worth noting he's opening it up for HBO. So it's going to be on HBO. So everybody's going to see it. So.
Oh, my God. The seal of approval. The golden seal of approval from American culture. You're on HBO.
You're on HBO. That's it.
I appreciate your time and helping kick off this national conversation, guys.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All Thank right. you.
Okay. Bye All now.
Right. And we're back with a few recommendations and things we should talk about. Who's going to take the Hamilton recommendation?
We all recommend
work. Angelica.
I remember that night. I regret that night. So for the rest of my days.
Tomorrow, on Friday the 25th, which is around the time this podcast will be up, the soundtrack of
the original cast recording.
The original cast recording of Hamilton will be out. It's been playable on this NPR site since Monday. I have avoided it because I know, and I've seen a lot of funny tweets. Like I tried to listen to his background music and had to stop what I was doing. It's like,
did you see my tweet about that?
What was your tweet?
Turns out Hamilton's is really good, but not good for Becker.
Exactly.
Listening.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of tweets along those lines. And so I'm like, I would need to like basically take a day off. And I want to wait. I want to wait for the record to come out and put on my headphones. And
well, it's actually really good at subway listening.
Great subway listening.
Great subway listening, because you don't have to, you just sit there and just listen to the words. And then 40 minutes later, you're at home and you're like, oh my God, I need that ride to be longer so I can listen to this some more. But now I have to go back to real life. It's really sad.
How do you stream on the subway?
You download it before you get on the subway.
You start playing it before you get on the subway and it'll continue playing.
This is important information for me. I didn't realize that.
But if you buy the album, you can play wherever you want.
Guess I can retire that bootleg I recorded at the Public.
Whoops! Just kidding. Please don't kill. Please don't steal Westman.
I will just give my only recommendation is a bit of a repeat, but I cannot recommend this strongly enough. It's now one of the Slate Panoply podcasts. You must remember this. Karina Longworth's podcast about old Hollywood is a delight.
You recommended this before.
I recommended her Charles Manson.
He loves it that much.
Series. But this is, she's, man, her Gable Lombard thing was amazing. Her Katharine Hepburn thing was amazing. Her Audrey Hepburn. I can't recommend highly enough. Marilyn Monroe. The Monty Clift, Liz Taylor one broke my heart. It's great. It's great. If you have any taste for old Hollywood and gossip, it's just her basically and a few guest voices. It's great. It made me start to think about, is there anything like this for theater? Is there a theater history and, you know,
well, Jen Tepper
dish?
Would have it if she.
Yeah, that would be what it would be, I suppose. a theater history and dish and analysis and criticism. It's so good. Can't recommend it highly enough. I'll try to come up with something fresh for next time. Deep, what else do you have besides Hamilton Deep?
Sure. I'm going to recommend Matthew Lopez's play, The Legend of Georgia McBride.
All right.
At MCC Theater. It originally got a production with the world premiere at Denver City Center Theater Company last year. And our Denver critics wrote us in saying that it was the best thing they saw that year. So I'm going to recommend that because it's a heartwarming play about a straight boy who puts on a dress and becomes a man. Nice. And it's a very profound experience. And there's just some amazing costuming in it. And the quick changes are fast and furious. And you can see them doing it on stage. And Mark McGrath, the actor who plays a drag mother in this.
Is it Mark or Matt?
McGrath? Matt. Sorry. Matt McGrath, who plays a drag mother.
He's amazing in it.
He plays a drag mother in Georgia McBride. Her name's Tracy something.
So good. Best part of the show.
And in the middle of the show, he has this epic musical theater montage number where he lip syncs like six different musical theater songs within 2 minutes. It's fantastic.
Aren't they like R&B remixes of it too? Like, it's not like, am I lying about this?
No. He started off with the original I'm Not Getting Married Today from Company.
Oh, right. Yeah. The drag shows.
The drag show is the best part.
Hold my tongue on that show. I didn't love it, but Matt McGrath was amazing. I'm going to recommend, I just saw Ugly Lies the Bone at Roundabout Theater Company, which is Lindsay Ferrantino's play playing at Roundabout Underground and starring Mamie Gummer. I originally saw a reading of it at the O'Neill Theater Center 2 summers ago when it was there, and it's getting its first New York production. I have some qualms with the play, but I think it's definitely very interesting, and we're seeing it uses video game technology. It's about a war veteran who comes home with a lot of burns all over her body and uses video game technology to try and recover. And the way they've integrated it in a very small black box theater is interesting. So if you're in New York, it's worth checking out.
I see. That was one of the repeatedly recommended plays in our season survey.
It's been around the development rounds. It's had readings a lot of places.
And so people were looking forward to it from all over the country, actually. They're looking forward to that play after it plays here, hopefully going somewhere else.
Yeah, Mamie's very good in it. And the makeup that they've done for the burn effects is insane. It's a small theater. It's very, very tiny. And to be able to do that good makeup and make it feel real is kind of amazing.
It's fair to say she's on fire in this play. I'm sorry, that's terrible.
It's a terrible pun.
It's almost as bad as our pun for Rajiv Joseph's Guards of the Taj.
What was that? I don't remember.
A bloody good time?
You know, give him a hand.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Because the play is about two guys who have to chop off a lot of hands.
Thanks for explaining that. On that exciting note, it's been an amazing week, and we hope you'll tune in next time to Off Script.